Hi, my name is Natalie Gochner. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political left, Shireen Gorbani.
Hello, and hey, listeners. A special hello to Joyce, who said hi to me the other day.
Love it. We love our listeners.
That personal touch.
John Dougal's in the studio on the right.
Always great to be with you guys.
Excited to have an energized conversation because it's election time, and we have a very close race in the 2nd Congressional District. Celeste Malloy, Becky Edwards, neck and neck. Looks like Bruce Huff may not make it there. We're recording this on Wednesday before 5 o'clock, so tonight we'll learn more. Just awkward for our listeners, for us as well. But why don't you break this down, John?
Well, it's an interesting race. We saw polling a couple of weeks ago that showed Becky at 32%. And so a lot of people thought, she's going to win this thing hands down. From my perspective, what it was is you had the liberal wing of the Republican Party had all solidified behind Becky, but you had concerns and folks trying to figure out, I believe, whether they're going to back Bruce or Celeste on the conservative wing of the party. And so we started seeing the trends of, last night, Celeste came out on top. Now, as I talked to folks in rural Utah, where she really had a great showing, they viewed her as the commoner, the average person, versus the wealthy elites from
the Wasatch Front.
The Wasatch Front or Park City, coming down there trying to tell them what they should do and how they should think.
Yeah. Shireen, did you know there was a liberal wing of the Republican Party in Utah?
I thought it was all the Democrats that registered as Republicans.
I rest my case.
I do. And what I think, though, is that this is sort of a broader trend when we look at kind of statewide trends that or these kind of larger races, that often there is a more present moderate middle in the Republican Party than we sense from maybe some of our elected representatives in the state legislature, or when we think about some of the more kind of flashy characters maybe that are in the Republican Party. And so I would just say from this perspective, kind of following just generally the rhetoric, the things that they were saying, the issues that they were talking about of these three candidates, I'm kind of happy to see that sort of push towards a more moderate voice, even though Celeste, I think, is quite conservative. My sense is that her approach to it is a little bit more one that feels rooted in real, consequential, meaningful ideas and an ideology that's not just based on culture war politics. And I'm really grateful to have maybe a little bit more emphasis on people who are willing to stay out of that most extreme kind of corners of the Republican Party.
Folks I've talked to describe Celeste as a bridge builder. She's the one boots on the ground getting things done for Congressman Stewart over the years. So,
yeah. Listen, these are three really strong candidates. I was pleased with the selection that were given to voters. I do not know Celeste. I know the other two and think very highly of both of them. And what I've seen of Celeste looks like it could be really good for our state. So, I'll be interested to watch this. What's the interesting part of it, though, and Shireen, I'll ask you to weigh in here, is we're going to get a woman, it looks like.
Yeah.
Because we've got Senator Kathleen Reby, who's my current senator, but she's running on the Democratic side for this seat. So the likelihood is you'll have either Celeste Malloy or Becky Edwards running against Kathleen Reby.
Yes. And our Senator Reby would be a great congressperson. But I have to say that I think that there's a lot to be said for looking at our congressional delegation and really seeing a lack of diversity in many ways, right? To have a woman in that body, Mia Love used to be there, but then we've had long stretches where it is completely represented by men. We're fully represented by men. When we think about the kinds of issues that continue to bubble up and the real concerns that I have around people's access to reproductive health care, when I think about kind of many of the ways that women's issues are deprioritized on the national stage, I'm grateful to have more women's voices at the table. And I think there's some research that suggests they are those bridge builders. They're people who are willing to kind of work across party lines to get things done. When we think about the childcare cliff that's looming, when we think about all the ways that women's lives are impacted, I will be grateful to have a woman in that seat.
John, I'd just like you to comment on that. Does it mean as much to you as it feels like it means to both Shireen?
It probably doesn't mean as much because it's much more personal for you. But I think it makes sense in terms of representation and getting more diversity of voices.
Yeah.
But along the same line, you also have folks in southern Utah who are saying this is our real chance of having somebody from our area also represent us in Congress. And so it's a diversity of voices, which I think is good.
That saying, you can't be what you can't see. And I think it means a lot for our state's reputation from the outside and also for all of the young women on the inside to see a woman in Congress representing our state.
Yeah, that's right.
That's lovely. One more thing before we leave this. The urban-rural divide is fascinates me here because it appears that there is quite a divide in who they chose.
Massive. If you look at those returns, absolutely.
Okay. I find that unfortunate. And what I mean there is the linkages between urban and rural Utah are significant.
Yeah.
And if anything, urban Utah, you know, does a ton to support rural Utah. The minimum school program brings, you know, income tax dollars from the urban areas and shares it with the rural areas. The gas tax paid for, you know, in the northern Utah and shared with all these roads all over the state. I'm just making the point that we should be more united. I'm looking at John, but he's just looking right back at me.
What do you mean by more united?
I'm just surprised at the disparities. Yeah, that, you know, that one candidate does well in urban and one does well in rural, because I think the issues are very commingled.
And I guess what I could offer to this is I spent a lot of time knocking on doors in places like Delta, even down in Big Water, on the edges of the district as far out as I could go, talking to people all over, including Eureka. Like, I went to every county, right, and talked and knocked on doors and talked to people. And what you're saying resonates with me, because the issues that I found that people had were actually quite similar. But for me, right, an example would be a person who has a disabled husband and knocked on her door in Tooele, right, in the heart of Tooele. She had a roof that had been damaged in a storm. To figure out the steps that that individual needed to take to get help in affording a repair that she simply did not have the money to do was so much more complicated. But I think a lot of the issues that people experience in urban settings are also the issues that people have in rural settings. It's just even harder for people to overcome those challenges because of the lack of resources.
We need each other. I mean, urban Utah needs rural Utah for its energy and for its food and, you know, for a lot of – for its recreation.
Yeah, tourism.
And rural Utah needs urban Utah's wealth.
Yeah, but if you get into some parts of rural Utah, they feel like – the federal government has been at war with them. Mm-hmm. Whether it was the Obama administration, you saw some of the blue counties flipping red as a result of his war against coal and other things like that. And I think there's a lot in rural Utah who look at Joe Biden's economy and his agenda, and it just is a concern to them.
And we do have a history of downwinders. And I really do think I learned a lot about St. George and the deep conservatism and really anti-government sentiment there that's often driven out of a history of being lied to and poisoned by our government. And I can understand. It's difficult for me, but I understand exactly where they're coming from.
Excited to watch how this turns out. Let's jump to another kind of local thing before we take a break. Senator Romney, he's going up in the polls. I've kind of been watching this closely. Of course, we've got two Republicans that are going to do an intra-party challenge in Brad Wilson and the
Trent Staggs.
Trent Staggs.
Mayor of Riverton.
Yeah. You know, but Romney, for whatever reason, is starting to pop a bit. And it's interesting to me because right when these other candidates got in and as the election got closer, he started to be more communicative, at least from what I saw. I started getting these emails from him, seeing pressers, you know, having him do tours.
Interesting, because I'm not seeing the emails or any of that type of stuff.
I definitely
took you off the list, John.
I got a fundraiser.
I didn't take
the
list.
The question is, let's make a prediction. Shereen, do you think he runs again, and when does he announce?
I do. I feel like there's a little energy that – I see what you're saying. I've seen these kinds of moments. I also feel like there's a little bit of so I think it'll be soon. Mm-hmm. I guess I should say that.
Yeah. How about you, John?
I think he's going to leave people wondering a little bit longer.
As long as he can, huh?
Don't make a decision until you have to. But I think the key thing is if he decides he's not running, then he becomes a lame duck and people don't listen to him. And he has a lot of concerns with former President Trump, especially him running again, having the possibility of becoming president again. And so I think from his perspective, if I were him, it would be focused on how do I stay relevant? How do I stay a focal point that people will listen and talk about his concerns in his battle against Donald Trump?
You know, from what I know about Senator Romney, he's the kind of guy that likes to get things done. And I bet you he's looking at the Senate, you know, in a forward-looking fashion and wondering how is he going to get anything done. And I say that because some of his, you know, sort of bipartisan cross-the-aisle people aren't running again or aren't going to be elected. So I think that weighs into his decision.
Yeah.
Just a guess.
Well, I think you also have the dynamic of how are the poll numbers looking?
Yeah.
I mean, John, if it looks like you don't have a chance, then maybe he
hangs it up. But they're looking good, yeah.
But it's looking better, so.
Yeah. John, in the case of Brad Wilson, our current Speaker of the House, do you think he's going to run against him whether Romney's in or not?
I think it depends on when Romney makes an announcement.
Okay.
I mean, right now, if Romney were to make an announcement tomorrow, then, you know, Speaker Wilson would clearly make a decision one way or the other based on that announcement. If we're waiting until December for Romney to make an announcement, fall being as late as December 20th, if you will, then I think Speaker Wilson has to fish or cut bait before that.
Yeah. So, Shireen, this is a big deal, right? Because John's kind of given the bookends, but I think Speaker Wilson will make an announcement in November. I'll bet it's in the early November.
Yeah.
And in doing that, I'm not sure if Romney will have decided by then. And I'm kind of guessing that they're both going to be in this.
I think you may be right. I will say, you know, we're talking about what this means to the future of the Senate, but I also feel like what Brad Wilson's absence in our legislature could mean is also a confusing landscape, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And the idea is if he resigns his seat, then we're going to get Mike Schultz as Speaker, and there's a different style and a different way of doing things, and it will affect our state. So these are big political moments.
Well, Mike is currently a majority leader, and that's why Natalie's saying he's probably likely first in line to replace the Speaker.
Yeah, just kind of following the, you know, what tradition has been, and he's earned the spot. So, hey, well, we've got more to talk about in the second segment. Stay tuned, everybody.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gorbani, on the left.
John Dougal, on the right.
And I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. We spent our first segment talking about the 2nd Congressional District and Senator Romney. I want to talk about Senator Lee for just a minute here. He got the Taxpayer Friend Award. No surprise there for me. This guy is so headstrong about not spending money that sometimes there's very worthy things in Utah that he won't support. Has that been your experience, John?
But a lot of times those spending activities are things that the state could do itself or local governments.
Yeah. And Shireen, what he often does is he finds a way to cut spending elsewhere so he can spend something more. You know, he always wants it to be a neutral. But, you know, if you want to comment on that, but I thought what you might be more interested in commenting on is his comments about the Burning Man flooding.
Oh, being God's judgment. No, I think I'm more interested in his tax policy, honestly, because
why give airtime to the other?
Why give airtime?
You didn't get stuck in the mud.
Let's tell the listeners what happened there.
So what's happening or what had happened at Burning Man, which is a sort of arts and culture festival, I guess. I'm not sure if you haven't heard about it. I'm not the person to explain it to you, but it is out
in Woodstock 2023.
No, there's not music. So, anyway, so there,
it's hard to explain. I mean, why do you go to Northern Nevada for anything?
Out,
you know,
in the desert, and there, it's a time when often there's extreme heat, but because of a changing climate, the weather can be quite unpredictable, and they experience pretty severe storms for that region. And the ground is this sort of dust, and it turned into just clay. And so there were all these images of people being stuck out there. But I think in the grand scheme of things, for me, two takeaways on that. I should say somebody did die. That's horrific. Like, obviously, we don't want to make light of that. But there's I just couldn't care less what happens at Burning Man, honestly. You got stuck in the desert.
Yeah.
I
was a little surprised when I heard there were upwards of 80,000 people there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's huge. It's a huge
festival.
This
isn't just like a handful of people camping.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I have a good relationship with Mike Lee, and I respect a lot of things about him. I would encourage him never to tweet about judgment and God's judgment. Mm-hmm. And I only say that because you just don't know people's life experiences. So it's a pretty broad brush.
Yeah, it's really taken on a lot to be the voice of God. Mm-hmm. Jeez.
Yeah. So, hey, well, some other things. Let's go to Clarence Thomas next. That guy, I guess he's now disclosed his trips and whatnot. I'm glad to hear that. But it's not real pretty. I guess it's ProPublica that released all of the travel. He had failed to disclose at least 36 luxury trips with a wealthy guy, a mega donor named Harlan Crow. This is a bad take. It doesn't feel right to me. I'm glad he disclosed.
Well, failed to disclose? I mean, he said he was disclosing per the rules. The rules have now changed, so he's increased his disclosure based on the change of rules. Now, I get
John,
that it sounds—
do you really want to defend him, though?
Well, you were saying he violated the rules is what I heard you saying. And I'm just saying my understanding is he didn't violate the rules. Now, some of this coziness and stuff like that.
Did he violate the spirit?
I don't know if he violated the spirit. I mean, if you go way back in our history, you got Marbury versus Madison. You had Marshall, who was Secretary of the State and sitting on the Supreme Court as Chief Justice, ruling on an issue that he was on. So, I mean, we got conflicts of interest all throughout our history.
Hopefully we've learned since
then. Now, we've got this weird, bizarre thing, and I don't know how this fully works when you have so many security concerns and your security folks are saying you need to travel on private travel and you don't necessarily have deep pockets. How do you do that? I don't know. I don't know those kind of dynamics. But I get for you the notion of being too cozy with certain folks does not look good.
Yeah, you know, selling land to them. To me, it's along this thing that you've got a lifetime appointment. You're sort of a ward of the government, meaning we take care of you. Don't go do stuff like this. You know, do something else.
I couldn't agree more. I think
meaning if you want to be on the Supreme Court, don't be hanging out with billionaire mega donors on multiple trips.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think we've built a system that encourages it and kind of requires it for people to be at the level of consideration for the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. It requires these kinds of cozy relationships and really has often little to do with people's background and more to do with their connections, which is often how a lot of things work in politics. But I do think it diminishes the reputation and I think my faith in the Supreme Court.
If you saw, you know, a former Supreme Court justice that was a woman that's very famous, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. If you saw her doing this, would you criticize it?
Yes, I think this
I thought you would.
Yeah, I think this is deeply troubling behavior. And I think it, again, erodes our trust in these institutions that are supposed to be there as backstops against kind of other systems that we know are imperfect as well. But I think it's rotten.
Yeah. John, anything more?
My point is, we've had this dynamic going on for generations and stuff like that. But I also view that there's some. Sheldon Whitehouse seems to want to play all sorts of games. You can't even talk to the newspapers without him getting offended that Supreme Court justices are issuing inappropriate opinions when they talk even with the press. Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit that's overblown.
Yeah. John, just because I'm interested, I find it interesting that your first instinct isn't to say, this is not something I would do, or I don't agree with what he's done here, but rather to provide context to make it seem okay.
Well, I was just coming from the perspective. In the past shows, I expressed some concerns of how this doesn't look good and it causes question and concern. I was just responding to what it sounded like.
Yeah.
You're saying he didn't follow the rules, and my understanding is he did comply with largely the rules.
Yeah.
There were some technical corrections he needed to make.
Yeah.
You know, like
my guess is
home.
I was inaccurate or inartful in how I described it.
Okay.
But I just wanted to ask you, like, do you condemn what he does? Like, do you think it's okay to be going on these big fancy trips with mega donors?
I'm not going to condemn it because I don't live in that situation, but I do have concerns.
Yeah.
And I think we've seen these type of dynamics, regardless of, quote unquote, which side of the aisle justice happens to be on.
Yeah, fair enough.
Okay, but I guess the question that I have is, do you think there should be a more clear code of ethics? And so if he didn't break this rule, do you think the rule should change?
Well, I think the code of ethics needs to be set by the Supreme Court, and I do think they should have a set of ethics. But the other dynamic is some want to play games with, okay, now we're going to have to force recusal of this justice and that justice and other things like that. And now we're going to play games about which justices can actually sit on the court. And that's where I go back to the example of Marshall more than 200 years ago and say he was sitting as the Chief Justice hearing a case that dealt with him as Secretary of State.
Yeah.
If there's not a more blatant conflict of interest, I don't know what is.
Well, I'm always grateful for the history lesson, but I also think we have an opportunity to do better. And I wish in this context we would.
And I'm glad he amended previous filings, trying to make right by it. Okay. Mitch McConnell, 81 years old.
Yeah.
I don't know what his nickname is in Washington, but he's arguably the most effective, powerful senator in a couple of generations. I mean, he's something special, what he's been able to do and the power he has. But he's frozen at press conferences twice in the last 2 months.
These are press conferences. He's called people together.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't just kind of he froze in other dynamics.
Yeah. And you know, apparently he's clearing all sorts of, you know, medical clearances. And this is a normal thing after suffering a concussion that came from a fall. But it does beg the question, do we not think that there's other really capable people that could be there?
Yeah.
In other words, if I'm advising him or if I'm him, I'm thinking to myself, why does it have to be me, given what's going on in my world?
Yeah, I think we have a system that relies on people's desire to stay in power, unfortunately.
A lot of seniority rewards.
Yep, it really does.
The voters see that and they want to keep that seniority.
It'll be interesting to see because I think there have been some interviews, and I don't know if there's been recent polling, but, you know, some interviews with Kentuckians who are saying that they don't really feel like he's, you know, fit to serve. I have to say the thing that stood out to me and is actually on our rundown as well was the kindness that Biden showed him to really just say.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, isn't it? And I think it also speaks to the kind of leader that Biden is, so much built on relationships.
John, did you see that, what Biden did?
I heard his comments about what he was going to do, so about reaching out and talking with his friend and stuff like that.
Yeah. This is pretty interesting.
But you're talking, I mean, we've got Mitch McConnell. Clearly, I have concerns about his age and ability to perform there. We got Dianne Feinstein on the other side of the aisle.
It crosses both sides,
we
for
got
sure.
Orrin Hatch years ago, who hit a point where I don't think he was fully there, but he was still in office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, what do you do? If you're a public policy person, what do you do in this situation? The two, you know, schools of thought are the voters are the ones that got to figure this out, but you could also have term limits.
You could have term limits. So Nikki Haley's talking about that. Term limits.
I haven't heard that.
Really cognitive is. Tests for individuals. I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for what could be done. But I what I would love to see is people be able to make choices that are good for them and also potentially better for our democracy.
Mm-hmm. I've advocated for term limits for full-time elected officials.
Have you done that for a long time?
Yeah.
It's interesting. I had to come to that. Yeah, I have this motto of always keep an open mind. When it comes to public policy, I'm not bothered at all when people flip-flop, so as they say. I think you learn and you make assessments based on what you see and know. And I crossed that road a little while ago that I favor term limits at this point. And it's kind of one of these things where I actually like people being professional in office. And I like to give them enough time to reach where they can benefit from their experience and, you know, what they've seen. But once you pass, like, 15 years... Once you pass 12, something like that, seems a little long to me.
Well, and the key thing, as I said, full-time elected officials. You know, our part-time legislature that really can only do things as a group and stuff like that.
Yeah.
To me, that's a little bit different.
Good
it's hard
you,
for them
John.
To keep
that's
entrenched
a nice
in
clarification.
Office versus the full-time that can use their office to entrench themselves.
John, we got the 14th Amendment weighing large right now because of our former president and what it looks like could happen where he could be seen as a insurrectionist. What's the legal rundown there?
Yeah, tell us what is in Section 3 of the 14th Amendment.
Section 3 came along right after the Civil War, and one of the dynamics has in here is that no person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of president and vice president or hold any office civil or military under the United States, and it continues, that shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemy. Okay, so some people want to use this as a tool to keep Donald Trump off the ballot.
If I were Mike Pence, I'd be all over this.
Okay, now I think this is, from my perspective, playing the legal guy on the radio that's not really an attorney, but you're looking at this and saying, I think it's hard-pressed to say legally, you've met the requirements that said engaged in insurrection. I think you've got to litigate that thing. And if somebody is convicted of that, then I think this applies. Mm-hmm. I mean, you look at the other things when we have something, you got to be a certain age or you got to be a citizen, you know, a natural born citizen. Those things are clear cut. Here, this is nebulous. Did someone engage in insurrection or rebellion or not? I think you've got to litigate that first before you can then make the decision whether or not they're eligible to run for these type of offices. The other thing that's interesting is it says no person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of president and vice president. It doesn't actually say you can't be president. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, I think it's hard-pressed for people to use this to keep Trump off the ballot from my perspective.
Yeah. Shereen?
Well, I would love for us to be able to figure out a way to keep Trump off the ballot that I'm looking to you. It's your party. But, you know, to me, it seems that a person who tries to overturn the election of the people, the choice that voters in this country made, should not be eligible to run. And I don't know what mechanism by which we figure that out, but there is plenty of legal action, I think, happening around the former president that might disqualify or make it difficult for him to move through the process.
The tool is impeachment and conviction.
Okay. I'm feeling a lot of deja vu, Groundhog Day kind of feelings. You know, it was the conventional wisdom initially when Trump first ran for office that he could never break through because you know, for reasons you know. And yet he keeps breaking through. And it's so disappointing to a conservative like me because he doesn't represent conservatism to me. He represents whatever is popular at the moment.
Opportunism and populism.
So yeah. I find that really difficult. Well, last thing, Shireen, we've got, it looks like the folks who wanted to get in the way of the flag didn't get enough signatures. What's next for the flag in our state?
You know, I'm not sure. But what I do hope is that people embrace our new flag. My understanding is that they're trying to put a ballot measure together, but it doesn't seem like that's going to happen.
Yeah. And our former host, Dan McKay, can just keep smiling ear to ear. And I am noticing that you're seeing the flag more and more and more, the new flag.
Or the logo on the flag.
Yeah. So it's a good take for all of us. Hey, you've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle with John Dougal, Shireen Gourbani, and Natalie Gochner. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.